Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, 7/7/17. And I'm here to talk about the important stories that I think you need to know about that are in the news today. It might be a different menu from what you see in the mainstream media. And you get my opinions, too, and it's all free. We're on Facebook Live and, of course, recording this for the Peter B. Collins audio podcast, which is available on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, and also on YouTube. So there are many ways that you can access the podcast on a daily basis, and I hope you will. My lead story today is about Rachel Maddow and her top-rated program on MSDNC. Yes, over the last few months, MSNBC has had a surge in ratings, and Rachel Maddow is number one in her time period. With Bill O'Reilly out of the way, well, the Russia-Trump narrative is what has fueled the surge in her ratings. And last night I was struck because for the first time, as a part of her ongoing coverage of what I call, you know, Rachel Pravda Maddow, she brought out the fact that there are actually skeptics of the Trump narrative, the Trump-Russia narrative, that she feeds and expands on a daily basis. And as you know, I remain prepared to embrace this narrative if we ever get any evidence, and if we ever see the leakers who have fueled these reports go public and, really identify the credibility of the claims that have been published in the media and piled one atop the other. But still, we have a glaring lack of facts, and in a moment, we'll get to the meeting that Trump had with Putin today in Hamburg, Germany. But on the Maddow show last night, for me, the biggest takeaway was that she admitted that there are skeptics of the work that she has been producing and churning out on a daily basis. And she brought up screenshots of articles from The Intercept. And while The Intercept has been generally skeptical of the Trump-Russia narrative, led by reporter Matthew Cole, they kind of broke ranks with the Greenwald point of view, Glenn Greenwald's, a few weeks ago when they published the NSA document, which we believe was leaked by Reality Winner. And that document, which I found less than compelling, John Kiriakou, the former CIA officer who was on our show last week, said, yeah, he said that was just an assessment and an analysis. It really didn't include any evidence. And he said the document shouldn't have been classified to begin with. But using that as an example, Maddow says that she and her team of reporters and producers at NBC have declined to go forward with a leaked document that she's highly suspicious of. Now, I'm glad that Rachel has some skepticism because we've seen it in very short supply in the past few months. And so she and her crew looked at this document, which we are told identifies an individual, a specific person in the Trump campaign as working with the Russians on their hacking attack on the election last year. Well, they have declined to publish the document, and they have deemed it to be a forgery. Well, that's good. That is good journalism, to carefully examine information that is leaked to you before you just put it on and claim that it is true. So that's progress. But by using the Reality Winner case, by using the document that we believe she leaked, they took a look at the little micro dots, the watermark that printers put on documents, particularly printers that are under the control of the NSA. And Rachel went into gruesome detail about how you can track who actually accessed the document and who directed a printer to print it. She didn't bother to tell us that it was Matthew Cole who went to one of his sources at the NSA with the leaked document attributed to Reality Winner and probably was responsible for her being identified and arrested even before The Intercept published her document. And to this day, The Intercept maintains that they don't know that it actually came from her. It's just from an unidentified source. And we're told The Intercept has an investigation underway where they're going to get to the bottom of all this. And so we have these dueling news sources. And just before I sat down here, I browsed through quickly the latest commentary from Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, where he raises questions about the piece that Rachel did last night, and in particular the citations of The Intercept and the alleged document attributed to Reality Winner. And it appears that the forgery that Maddow has declined to show us or give coverage to was a crude forgery lifted from some of the same text and details of the NSA document, again, attributed to Reality Winner. So this is a very interesting break in the sequence of events. Rachel Maddow has never, to my knowledge, invited somebody like Robert Perry or Glenn Greenwald to come on her show and share skepticism of her narrative. It's a bubble at MSNBC, and only the people who toe the party line are permitted to enter that bubble and, lavish praise on Rachel Maddow and agree with her at every turn. So I found this to be an interesting break in what we've been seeing so far. And to Maddow's warning to other journalists, I think it's well-placed. You cannot trust documents that fall into your lap. You cannot say that simply because you have a document that appears to be real, appears to be authentic, that you should publish it. And I wish that Maddow would embrace those kinds of standards on a daily basis. And I wish that Matthew Cole would resign from The Intercept, because in our in-depth interview last week with John Kiriakou and his co-author Joe Hickman, this is their new book. It's called The Convenient Terrorist. It's about Abu Zubaydah and details of his case that have never been brought forward before. And it turns out that both Joe Hickman and John Kiriakou were burned by Matthew Cole. And Kiriakou flatly said that he went to prison because Matthew Cole either did his job badly or intentionally ratted him out. And Joe Hickman told his story of how Matthew Cole burned him. And when Cole was working at ABC News, there was a plan to broadcast an interview with Joe Hickman about what he knew at Guantanamo on the night in 2006 when three prisoners left the main compound and came back dead. They were all described as suicides. And Hickman's story, which turned into a book, I find highly credible. And Matthew Cole compromised Joe Hickman. The government then issued a denial saying, Hickman, he was a guard, just a sentry post. He wouldn't know anything. And ABC accepted that and never ran the Hickman interview. So Matthew Cole is the one who is in my targets in this case. Now to the Trump-Russia connection. It's in a city in Germany called Hamburg. And alongside the G20 summit, there was this highly anticipated meeting between Trump and Putin. The meeting lasted 2 hours and 16 minutes, supposed to be under an hour. Only four people and translators were present, the two presidents and their foreign secretaries, Rexon Tillerson for the United States and Sergei Lavrov for the Russians. And one of the things that the American media has been teasing and that members of the U.S. Senate pressed Trump for was to confront Putin about the unproven claims that Russia interfered in our election last year. And since there were only four principals present, we can only get reliable information or leaks from one of those four. And Rex Tillerson, now playing Secretary of State in the Trump reality show, had these comments about the exchange between the Donald and the Vladimir.
The president opened the meeting with President Putin by raising the concerns of the American people regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election. They had a very robust and lengthy exchange on the subject. The president pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement. President Putin denied such involvement, as I think he has in the past. The two leaders agreed, though, that this is a substantial hindrance in the ability of us to move the Russian-U.S. relationship forward.
So that's Rex Tillerson, and I apologize. I pulled the audio there from a video clip on the Washington Post website, and it doesn't have a lot of volume, so I hope you're able to hear what he was saying. At any rate, it is a long-awaited meeting. We know that the two presidents talked about Syria. There is some discussion of a limited ceasefire in southwestern Syria, scheduled to begin on Sunday. And there is discussion of partnering to establish safe zones in Syria. And again, we don't know the dimensions of this. But, I'm not one of those people who believes that this meeting has to be something that leaves blood on the floor or somebody being served a polonium cocktail. I think that our fears of Russia and of Putin are seriously overblown, and the hysteria of the Trump-Russia narrative has fed that quite a bit. So it'll be interesting to see what else filters out in reporting. We are only getting the initial hits from the meeting in Hamburg today. And I want to reference the other great outlet where you get skeptical coverage of the whole Trump-Russia narrative, and that is Consortium News. And Bob Perry has a story up today criticizing the mainstream media, quote, still living in Propagandaville. And he hits them again for the blind republishing of the claim, which we know is not true, that 17 American intelligence agencies concurred that Russia meddled in our elections. This was launched into the rhetorical world by Hillary Clinton in a desperate move in the final debate last October, and it simply isn't true. There never has been a 17-agency review, and James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, and John Brennan, the former CIA director, have both acknowledged this in the past month or so. But the corporate media keeps referencing 17 intelligence agencies. And Perry notes is that they have cleverly kind of restructured their writing to suggest, you know, that this is still true without using the 17 number. So this is something that I think is critical. And when the media gets it wrong and they repeat a false claim that is partisan in nature, it came from the Democratic candidate, they have, I think, a real outsized obligation to correct it. But instead, they have kind of just revised their terminology without quite admitting that they have been publishing false information. Now, I mentioned Rex Tillerson. He's the former head of ExxonMobil. And as a, made man in the oil patch, he is being dispatched to Kuwait, where on Monday he is hoping to mediate the dispute between the Arab Gulf nation of Qatar and its former allies, members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. As you may know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, and Bahrain have issued demands to Qatar that they shut down the Al Jazeera news network and that they stop financing terrorists. But all these other countries finance terrorists, and the Saudis are the worst among them. Their proxy fighters in Syria are a real factor, much more than Qatar's influence there. And likewise, the war in Yemen is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Saudis. And so this claim, that they're destabilizing security in the region appears to be mostly aimed at the fact that Qatar shares a natural gas field with Iran and is closer to Iran politically than any of its neighbors. And they're trying to drive a wedge And there are some credible speculators who say, well, this could lead to, first, a Saudi takeover, an invasion of Qatar, followed by an attack on Iran, which would presumably be supported by the United States. So that is pure speculation, but it is credible, and it is something that we have to keep in mind as these issues roll out. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast and on the live Facebook feed with your subscriptions. People like Nixon. Yeah, I've got a Nixon who supports me. Did you know that? Her name's Pauline Nixon. Thank you, Pauline. Then there's Liz Kaiser, who just renewed her annual subscription. So did Judith Harper. And Alice Carlson is a monthly subscriber to the PBC Podcast. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, and you click on the menu button, no matter what device or platform you're using, and you pull it down. Then the next option is Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page. And if you take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., I've got bonus books, including this brand new one, The Convenient Terrorist by Joe Hickman and John Kiriakou. It can be yours if you take out a new annual subscription to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And I thought over here I had my my little card to invite you to call into the show, but I can't find it right now. I'm going to start taking your phone calls at the bottom of the hour, and you can get on the line now or in a few minutes. The number to call in on is 415-455-0102. That's 415-455-0102. And you can comment on any of the issues that I raise, or you can bring up a topic of your own. Now, I mentioned Rex Tillerson. He also is at least a partial focus of an investigation by the state of New York's Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman. And this goes back to when Tillerson was CEO of ExxonMobil, and he had a fake email account. And maybe it was to manage his Ashley Madison account, you know, the cheaters website. I don't know. Anyway, his fake name was not Carlos Danger. It was Wayne Tracker. And the Attorney General of New York is not going to set up a deposition with Wayne Tracker, but he wants to talk to Exxon's former CEO, Rex Tillerson. And the issue is that shareholders allege that the management of ExxonMobil refused to share its internal studies related to climate change and its impact on the oil industry. Because, of course, it could cause a cataclysmic end to the use of fossil fuels if we ever get smart about it. And the shift to renewable energy could have a depressing effect on energy stocks like ExxonMobil. So I think it's a fair lawsuit. He may wind up being deposed there, and I think that would be an interesting precedent for a sitting Secretary of State. All week, while, you know, we took a long weekend and indulged in lots of barbecue and beer, Mitch McConnell and his friends, Republican friends in the United States Senate, have been in contact on the back channels trying to figure out where they can get 51 votes to repeal Obamacare. And Mitch McConnell yesterday indicated that he might not ever find those votes. And this could create an even worse situation than we have today, where the markets are undermined by the negative talk about Obamacare and the imminent threat to repeal it. And this can cause a lot of unforeseen occurrences and plenty of damage to the people who rely on Obamacare for their insurance coverage. So it's possible that nothing will happen. It's also possible that they'll find the votes just to repeal Obamacare and leave millions of people uncertain about what's going to happen next year. But to its credit, the New York Times today published a story showing that the biggest subsidies to health care are not Medicaid, and they are not related to the Obamacare coverage of people like me, self-employed individuals who are buying health insurance through the exchanges created under the Affordable Care Act. No, the biggest hit, which costs billions of dollars a year, Let's see, about $174 billion a year. Is the subsidies to employers' health care coverage for their employees? And the way this works is, if your employer pays you $100,000 a year, you get a W-2 that says you owe taxes on $100,000. The health insurance that is subsidized by your employer is not taxable either to the employer or as income to the employee. This benefits wealthy people more than poor people. And it also is a huge drain or a drag on the economics of healthcare. And some analysts believe that if it were trimmed or even eliminated, that it might actually level the healthcare markets and lead to reductions in healthcare costs. Because the people who have Cadillac plans paid for by their employer use health insurance because, hey, it's free. They use it more than the people who have to pay copays or pay the insurance out of their own pockets, even with subsidies under Obamacare. And what the New York Times failed to mention in any significant way in this otherwise good article is that the package that was passed by the House, the package that is proposed by the Senate, eliminates the employer mandate, meaning that you could be on your own. Even if you've worked for a company full-time for 30 years, they could say, hey, we don't have to supply insurance anymore. So go out and buy one of those substandard policies that the Republicans are talking about having lower premiums, but the premiums are lower because the coverage sucks. Paul Krugman gets it right. I have to say, I checked out on Krugman in his New York Times column last year when he was just so biased in favor of Hillary Clinton. But today he gets it right. He uses the term Decepticons to describe the Republicans in their approach to cutting taxes by cutting health care. And he says that they lie so often that he couldn't fit them all in one column. But he did, nevertheless, enumerate some of their bigger lies about what's really going on and the false claims of many Republicans that giving people a choice will lead to large numbers of uninsured because they don't want to buy health insurance. And that's an issue I talked about in my most recent in-depth interview with Professor Corey Dolgan. He's got an interesting new book out called Kill It to Save It, and he applies the Kill It to Save It frame to healthcare, to the privatization of education in this country, and to many other issues. And he gave me a great comment regarding the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan's, recent remarks where he suggested that poverty is a choice and that poor people just have to buck up and then they can afford to buy health insurance and live.
That's been part and parcel of the narrative, certainly since Reagan, and that is this kind of hyper-individualism and the Kill It to Save It framework that I write about looks at this hyper-individualism and what I consider a kind of corporate ideology that has really become the baseline of an ideological instinct in this country. And so, for instance, that language of choice really rings true to Americans, in part because it has to do with what they, the power they have as consumers or the power they have as individuals to make a choice. And then this notion that somehow the corporate ideology, the corporate sector, handles all of these things so much more effectively and efficiently that if people just leave corporations alone, we now call them job creators, they will in fact give us the opportunities as individuals to make the right choices, and that will lead to our success. And of course, the problems with that logic are legion. The idea somehow that people choose to be poor or they've made bad choices, on the one hand, disregards the incredibly poor choices that rich people make day in and day out, yet seem to have a cushion. Someone like George Bush, I often like to use in my class as an example of someone who pretty much failed at everything he did. Had a terrible substance abuse problem, yet up until the age of 30 or 35, he floated on the fact that he came from one of the most wealthiest and powerful families in the country. And then suddenly, within 10 years, 15 years, was the president of the United States. So One can make very bad choices if one has wealth and power in this country.
That's Corey Dolgan. He is a professor and the author of this new book called Kill It to Save It. Our in-depth interview is available for subscribers right now at peterbcollins.com and at iTunes and TuneIn and Stitcher and Spreaker. Well, this is the time where I open up the phone lines, and I'd like to hear from you today. You can talk about health care, you can talk about Trump and Russia, you can talk about Trump and Putin, or maybe there's something else on your mind that you would like to call in and comment on. The number to use is 415-455-0102. That's 415-455-0102. And a quick explanation. I tried to host today's video feed on my Facebook fan page. That's the one that's labeled Peter B. Collins Show. But when I tried to start it with my phone, I couldn't find the live video icon on the app on the Peter B. Collins Show page. So I had to shift over to my personal page, and it may have created some confusion, made it harder for people to find the podcast. I understand that. This is still an experiment and a work in progress, but I'm excited to be able to open up the phone lines here and let you comment, because in doing a podcast now for 8 years, I haven't been able to enjoy the exchange of views and the interaction, the unpredictable interaction with the people who are listening and watching on Facebook. So this is your opportunity, and you got to get on the line now, and then we can talk. 415-455-0102. And since I happen to have a copy of this bonus book sitting right next to me here, I'm going to dangle it as an inducement for the first caller. If you are the first caller today, you've got to get on the line now. I'll be happy to give you a free copy of the new book by Joe Hickman and John Kiriakou called The Convenient Terrorist. It's a fascinating look at the case of Abu Zubaydah, who was not the high-ranking al-Qaeda figure that the U.S. Intelligence leaders thought he was when we grabbed him in Pakistan and he was interrogated, and then they didn't think he had coughed up enough, so they waterboarded him and subjected him to the entire package of torture tactics that were designed by the consultants Mitchell and Jessen, who earned $81 million for that grisly work. So the book can be yours. All I need is a phone call from you and your pungent comment for the day. 415-455-0102. And we've got a caller right now. Who's this?
Hi, Peter. It's Kyle in Topanga. How are you today?
Hi. Nice to talk to you, Kyle. Good to hear from you.
Well, thank you. I called in, as you recall, when John Kiriakou was the guest.
Mm-hmm.
And we briefly discussed what politicians there are in the United States. We didn't get around to Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd ask you what your view of him is. As far as I can tell so far, he looks like the real deal. But I've been wrong before.
Well, I have to say that I've only read a few accounts about Jeremy Corbyn. In my daily news gathering, one of the outlets I always look at is The Guardian.
Yeah.
And I have to say I don't have a very clear opinion. My sense is that he is a true blue-collar progressive in the British context. And that he is a very credible opponent to the conservatives and to Theresa May.
Yeah.
For me, the bizarre process has been, you know, how Theresa May became prime minister without an election. It was just handed off to her as the leader of her party. And then she blundered badly in trying to call an early vote that she thought would strengthen her hand for Brexit. And, of course, it blew up in her face. And certainly the Labour Party showed tremendous gains in this past snap election. And I hope that it is a harbinger of, this idea that the Trump virus has to spread to every other country with a nominal democracy is something I reject. And I think that there are some smart British voters. Let me take a quick side trip because, you know, there's all this talk about what actually flipped the election for Trump in this country. And the most compelling case that I've seen is about the company called Cambridge Analytica, and that they were able to buy data on Facebook and other social media users.
Yes.
And that they were able to target really ugly, inaccurate, fake news messages, either promoting Trump or denigrating Clinton. And Cambridge Analytica's first big victory was the Brexit vote. And the funding documents show that the Brexit campaign spent somewhere, you know, north of 60% of the funds that they raised on online media directed by Cambridge Analytica. Well,
yeah.
Steve Bannon was on the board, and may still be, because nobody enforces the ethics rules anymore, of Cambridge Analytica. And knowing what I know from the activity in social media during last year's campaign, I know that the Democrats were running a very aggressive online operation directed by David Brock and using his dark money super PAC called Correct the Record. It included, we saw a couple of them expose themselves, people who were paid to police comments on Facebook and push back whenever anybody put up something positive about Sanders in the primary, Trump in the general, or critical of Hillary at any point in that, that cycle. And so when we hear all this talk about the bots and, you know, these fake news factories in Russia or Romania, I don't give as much credit to those as I do to the social media operation that was run by the Trump campaign. And knowing that there is no bottom when it comes to Trump, and knowing that you can target people who have racist attitudes, people who think that Mexicans are likely rapists, maybe there are some good ones, those people can be targeted through, you know, an analysis of their social media activity. So I took you on a long side trip there, Kyle. But I really think that that may be what was pivotal in the election. And we are now seeing this independent expenditure campaign that was being run by Peter Smith. And he basically put the word out on the dark web. Bring me Hillary's emails. I won't ask any questions and I'll give you cash. And whether it was Russians or people using NSA hacking tools that make it look like it's Russians, or, you know, somebody in a Karl Rove-style boiler room in Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, there were a lot of efforts made to influence the election. And I just think we need to look at the domestic suspects first before we start, you know, going into some of these far-fetched claims. And again, I've said if you can show me evidence, I'll embrace, you know, that Russia did it. But so far, no one has done that.
No, and I don't go there with Russia. I just don't I don't think that if it did happen, that it played much of a factor. To me, Hillary Clinton is by far the worst candidate. And by the way, I've never voted for a Republican, never in my life. You know, I'm 65. It takes a lot of work to get me to like a Democrat nowadays because they've betrayed pretty much everything, you know, since 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably, McGovern was the last decent Democratic candidate, although you can make a case for Carter. But to go back to Corbyn, you know, to me, it looks to me, unless we're being conned on a massive scale, I'll just give you one example. For a long time, I've been pounding the table with my friends, family, on Facebook, wherever I could, for accountability about Iraq. And it just astounds me that people are willing to let, you know, someone, a figure like, say, Obama, get away with not investigating and prosecuting Bush and Cheney. And when you talk about this to diehard Democrats, they get very uncomfortable, and they shuffle their feet because they hated Bush and Cheney and the war with a passion. And yet here they are endorsing a guy who, among other things, never mind the expansion of the drone war and all the other horrible things that Obama did, what he didn't do is arguably even worse. And here's where I bring Corbyn in. Corbyn is talking about getting some accountability for Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we're going to put any pressure on anybody in power in this country, it's going to have to come from the outside, again, to try and bring this back around so that we're looking at ourselves from outside of the looking glass.
Well, we're pretty well protected. We got Teflon all over the glass. And Kyle, just this week, some justice was delivered to Omar Khadr. He was 15 when we picked him up and began to torture him, first in Afghanistan, then at Guantanamo. And he received $8 million and an apology from the Canadian government.
But and of course, even that isn't enough.
Right, but we don't acknowledge, I mean, we were the cause of his distress, and
that's right.
We don't acknowledge a thing.
It's sad, isn't it? What we have done, we, the United States of America, have done in the last, especially the last 15 years, is it's any actual look at it, any real in-depth look at it, is heartbreaking. We have become the evil empire. We are the world nasties. You know, we're the ones with, 1,000 bases around the world?
Yep.
No other country comes close to this. Russia, when you start talking about Russians to me, I say, yeah, do you know how many bases the Russians have? And then they get nervous because they don't know. And I say, how about one at the invitation of the Syrians? There's one in Syria. You know,
mm-hmm.
Now who are the bad guys? So these are the things that make me, my voice, I can hear it in my voice talking to you. I become tight inside. I become, I clench my fist. It's like, how long is it going to take for some kind of decent accountability, for sanity to grip? I spent some time last year in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
And people go to Costa Rica from all over the world because it is a world-class destination. The animals, the ocean, just everything about it. And the fact that there's no military there. They haven't had a military in our lifetime. Wow. What a peaceful, wonderful place it is. And I go swimming or I talk to people over dinner. I met a lot of people, very nice people from all over the world.
Yeah.
Europe, Asia. And they, when they find out what my real political views are, when I disclose to them who I really am and what I really think about my own country, then they open up a little bit and they say, do you realize how crazy you look to the rest of the world? It's embarrassing, man.
Well, and every time Trump leaves the country and then tweets, and his tweet today is that everybody in Hamburg is talking about John Podesta and the emails.
You know, I despise Trump, but the only real value he does have, and it's a good thing, is that he's so beyond the pale. He's such a caricature of the ugly American that we know, even the Republicans know who they're dealing with. We are getting what we deserve here. Whereas if we had elected Hillary Clinton, we all would have gone, all the Democrats would have gone right back to sleep.
You're right. You're right, Kyle. Well, thank you for a great call. And Kyle, shoot me a mailing address by instant messenger on Facebook.
And anytime, sir. Yes, sir. I will do this.
This bonus book will be yours. And I do appreciate your call and your commentary today.
Oh, bless you. That's a great thing.
All right, Kyle. Good enough.
I'll see you next time.
All right, good. 415-455-0102 if you'd like to offer a comment today. A couple of quickies before I go. In the face of massive cuts to Planned Parenthood imposed by the Republicans as they pander to their evangelical base, we are faced with a new report from the World Health Organization of an untreatable epidemic of gonorrhea. It is spreading around the world. It is resistant to the current of antibiotics that we have. In Britain, the number jumped by 35,000 cases in the last year studied, which was 2014, and this could be a very serious problem. And just in case you're not aware, gonorrhea spreads through unprotected vaginal, oral, or anal sex, as well as through the sharing of sex toys that haven't been properly washed. Many of those who contract the disease experience no symptoms, but left untreated, it can cause infertility, and it can put babies at risk of blindness if it is infecting a pregnant woman. The judge in Hawaii who initially put a stay on Trump's royal decree, the travel ban 2.0, is deferring to the Supreme Court and will not rule on a request to define who is a bona fide relative for purposes of admission to the United States. And that's all I have time for today. I want to thank you for watching on Facebook. Thanks for listening to the audio podcast at peterbcollins.com or wherever you find it. And you can catch my podcast every weekday. I post at about 5 o'clock Eastern time, between 5 and 6 p.m. Eastern, 2 to 3 o'clock Pacific. And I usually am able to crank out 2 in-depth interviews a week, depending on who's available and when the schedules work out. And here's another call. Let's see who's on the line. Good afternoon. You're on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hey, Peter. It's Del from Maine.
Hey, how I'm good. How are you? Say your name again.
This is Del Leonard from Maine. How are you?
Oh, it's Del in Maine. Hey, Del. Good to talk to you.
Hey, good to talk to you. Am I on the air now? Or
you are. You're on Facebook worldwide. I hope you can handle that.
I'll try. I, because of my work schedule, I'm not able to listen to the first part of the podcast, so I don't know what topics you're covering this afternoon.
All right. Well, I started with Rachel Maddow, and that she has acknowledged that there actually are skeptics of her Trump-Russia fables.
Okay. What I wanted to ding you a bit on was the fire, the high-rise fire last month in London.
Yeah.
And you never mentioned that, or you never made the connection between here we have another, you know, high-rise fire. It burns for, you know, hours and hours. This one, I think, burned for more than 16 hours.
Right.
The structure didn't just fall in its own footprint and made the connection. So here we have another empirical example of, you know, a structure like, you know, steel frame, I'm sure,
mm-hmm.
concrete structure, burning for far longer than the towers or Building 7 did.
Right.
And yet it doesn't collapse. Just all the combustible materials just burn up.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're left with a structure.
I did mention it once. It was a quick reference. But, I have a tough time sometimes, Del, deciding which stories not to cover. Because
yes.
I only have a certain amount of time, and every day I leave stories on my desk that don't fit. And there are 3 of them here today that I'd love to fit in, but I'm not going to have time, and maybe I'll get to them next week. And I try to, you know, avoid over-covering stories that the big media are all over. And I also don't cover what I consider to be local cases, natural disasters, and things that I can't add some value to with a comment. And
right.
So, yes, I did at one point acknowledge that, you know, the structure remained in place. But I want you to know that your prodding has, it is working. You may have heard the in-depth interview with John Kiriakou and Joe Hickman.
I
asked them if they embraced the official story of 9/11. And they said basically yes. But then Kiriakou just out of the blue said, but I don't know what happened to Building 7.
Right.
So I have been trying more to get people to go on record as to whether they embrace the official version or acknowledge the what I consider to be the very obvious flaws in it. But it's difficult because we have it's been so long that people have hardened attitudes. And there's so many people who, as soon as you say, I've got questions about 9/11, they just say, well, you're an idiot.
Right.
Because I watched on TV, and I know it's true. And you cannot really dissuade people or persuade them away from that. And in the interviews, when it's not a central focus of the conversation, I sometimes pick and choose who I'm going to ask the question about 9/11.
But right, and then the Kiriakou interview. I'm really, I've been listening to that. I've been picking up that you've been questioning interviewees on that and timing it well. I guess the only thing I would add with John Kiriakou would say, hey, John, have you checked out all the work that architects and engineers have done and how they've hired this professor, or they connected with this professor in Alaska that he and his graduate students have done a very detailed, virtual model of Building 7 and just, kind of pushed him in that direction a little bit without kind of going out of the context of the interview as a whole.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand.
I know it's difficult to do that when you're trying to, you're on a certain path. You don't want to go off on these dark tangents or something like that. But.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a balancing act, and I try to achieve that. Well, Del, you are still my vice president for marketing in New England. And I appreciate all the work you've done to expose people to the PBC podcast.
I appreciate all the work you do, Peter.
And thank you for you were the one, pardon me, who reminded me that it was 8 years in early June.
It was 8 years.
That I began podcasting. So
it was.
All right, Del, good to hear from you. You take care.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
As always, I'm grateful. And thank you for joining us for the live video feed and audio podcast today. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.